This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On today's show, North Korean defectors risk their lives to escape to the South, but their challenges don't end once they cross the border.
Young children get bullied and say they want to go back home. We don't even know what to talk to South Koreans about. We don't know about actors or video games. It's difficult to make friends.
Plus, sugarcane crops are in trouble in Mexico as migrants head north in search of better jobs. And Roots Radio rocks Jamaica. The station helps listeners with everything from food to funerals.
I can't even find words to express. They support me with their love. They give me inner strength.
That and more ahead on the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Have you had your fill of reality TV? Can't bear the thought of one more singing, dating, moat-filled obstacle course show? Well, in one Nairobi slum, reality TV is just getting going. And it seems that a lot of residents there can't get enough of it. Richard Locke reports.
On a small patch of bare ground that passes for a school playground, these young students recite a poem about life in their slum.
Don't forget, Mama. Remember, teachers won. No books, no class. No pens, no class. No shoes, no problem.
Remember my school uniform, Mama. Remember teacher's warning. No books, no class. No pens, no class. No shoes, no problem. They're all pupils at the Future Kids Academy, a primary school for HIV-positive children and orphans. And today's recital? Well, it's destined for the big screen. A few feet away, a cameraman is shooting the action. Today's shoot is part of a new project called Slum TV. It gives a team of youths from Nairobi's notorious Mathari slum a video camera to record everyday life here. Then the videos are shown to residents in public viewings. The Austrian government funded the project's initial startup costs. Now a local artist is keeping Slum TV going while the group looks for more money. But what's the appeal of Slum TV to people living in Mathari? Well, many here never cross from one side of their slum to the other, let alone exit the maze of muddy alleyways and tin-roofed shacks. So, as volunteer cameraman Nicholas Mathenge explains, Slum TV exposes residents to slices of life they might not otherwise see.
Us at Slum TV want to show different type of activities which are happening and to show the different ideas through the Slum TV so they can know what is happening in the other side of the slum.
Mathari can be a place of crime, violence and an endless cycle of poverty. But the idea behind Slum TV is to show other aspects of life here.
This is our kitchen where we do our cooking.
Cameraman Mathenge follows Lydia Manyala, the feeding program director at Future Kids Academy, into the mud brick kitchen. Then he films the school's cook labouring over two steaming cauldrons of maize meal that will feed more than 400 kids today.
Most of our pupils come from poor families and they depend on this meal. So when they come in the morning, we provide porridge and then we provide lunch for them. And when it comes to evening, sometimes we give them some food to carry home.
Standing outside a classroom of eager six-year-olds, Mathenge explains why he wanted to film the work of this community-funded school.
We just wanted to show other people what kind of... We have good people who are needed. They need a lot of support, and they are doing it with their hearts, and the kids are learning very well, and they are performing very good in the school.
Mathenge is typical of the Slum TV volunteers. The 26-year-old dropped out of school at the age of 12 because his father couldn't afford the tuition costs. He faced a bleak future. But Mathenge was determined not to join the unemployed masses and, as he puts it, become an idle layabout, hooked on drink and drugs. So he taught himself photography using an old camera. Now with Slum TV, he's moved into video and his ambitions are growing.
I've learned a lot. I've been inspired. I want to be like a journalist.
Mathenge's also been shooting a video that looks at a day in the life of a garbage cart puller. His colleagues, meanwhile, have taped a group of Mathari youths who set up an acrobats troupe and now perform for tourists in Nairobi's luxury hotels. Mathenge and the other volunteers are looking to gain skills that will help them find a well-paying job. Already, some are making a bit of extra cash by videotaping marriages and funerals.
As you can see now, we are leaving from St. James Primary School. We hope you will watch Slum TV.
It's the monthly Slum TV night in Mathari. In a dirt courtyard, a white sheet has been tied up against the side of a building. The video starts rolling, and the narrator explains that tonight's first star is a well-known local donut maker. The video shows him in his cramped wooden kiosk, frying donuts in a vat of vegetable oil. A somewhat bemused crowd of adults smile as they watch. And then the power goes out, and the crowd heckles. But it's only a temporary blip. The next short film starts up. From time to time, the project puts together short feature films. This one is a comedy about a hysterical preacher who harangues his worshippers, steals their money, and loses his parish to a competitor. The audience loves it. After the screening, audience member Betty Shanti says it's a welcome change to see positive stories come out of Mathare.
There's so many good things to happen in Mathare area, so I must encourage those people to continue showing us the Slum TV so that we can have more power to go on.
So you'll be back next time?
Yeah.
Slum TV volunteers reckon there's money to be made, distributing their videos on DVD across the city. More importantly, though, they hope to build an archive of footage that tells the true story of Mathare. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in the Mathare slum, Nairobi, Kenya.
Now we take you farther south on the African continent to Botswana. Few people there own cars. Instead, they get around on foot or by bike. A couple of years ago, Bicycling Magazine helped launch a program called Bike Town Africa. The plan was to give bicycles to HIV/AIDS workers in rural areas. The bikes would help them get to patients who were spread out over the countryside. 9 months later, the magazine sent journalist Mark Jenkins to check on how things were going. He was surprised at what he found.
They used them constantly, day in and day out, until the bikes started having problems. For instance, the thorn bushes were puncturing the tires. The bikes came with patch kits, they came with pumps, but somehow those got stolen or misplaced or lost. And so what actually happened in some of these projects is that the bicycles, once they had a flat tire or once they had a mechanical problem, they were just abandoned because no one had the knowledge or the tools to repair them.
How many were actually in use when you arrived to check on the program?
No more than 50. I would say 150 of them were not in use when I arrived.
Were you discouraged? Did this kind of change the tone of the article you were wanting to write?
Absolutely. I think it was a bit of a shock for me, although it shouldn't have been because I'd worked in Africa. But, you know, you go with such high hopes. And so I went there thinking, oh, this is going to be a fabulous story to show how bicycles can change the planet. And I got there and 3/4 of the bikes were not working. And about midway through, I realized that I had an opportunity to change things or to just stay and write as a journalist and not become personally involved. And I couldn't take that. So I decided, look, I'm going to have to get personally involved if I want this thing to get back on its feet.
And so what did you do?
The first thing I did was start repairing bicycles and trying to teach some of the HIV/AIDS health workers how to repair their own bicycles. I also, with just cash that I'd brought, I bought more bicycle pumps. I bought tire patches. And in fact, they had realized that, look, these bicycles are a gift, but you have to maintain them yourselves, not simply something that you can use and abuse, and then when it stops working, you just give up on it.
So you moved to almost being a bicycle aid worker. How did they respond to you kind of stepping in and saying, you're going to take the bull by the horns and fix this problem?
That's exactly a great description. I got mixed reactions. In fact, of the 200 bikes, 100 were given to one program, BOCAPE, which is a HIV/AIDS outreach program, and another 100 bicycles were given to Bobonong's home base care. And BOCAPE was extremely pleased that I just jumped in and started fixing bicycles, buying patch kits. But I kind of had a different reaction from the Bobonong home base outreach program. There, they'd kept the 100 bikes in large shipping containers. And because of kind of the organization wanting to maintain control of the bicycles, no one was using those 100 bicycles. So when I got there, I said, we wanted those bicycles to remain with the people for them to use them daily. So I busted open that container and started giving bicycles away and saying, look, this is your bike. Keep it. It's yours. And yeah, I got quite a bit of bureaucratic resistance.
We're talking here about a program gone awry on bikes, but you've traveled all over Africa. I'm wondering if this is a common thing that you see where aid groups are trying to give aid or help in some village or region, and it falls apart just because a small piece is missing. Is this common?
This is absolutely common. In fact, I would call it the norm. I would think that the first year or two of any charity program has an enormous likelihood of failure. And I've seen tractors sent from the U.S. sitting in the dirt in Mali because they ran out of gasoline 10 years ago and they could never put gas in. I saw Russian tractors in Zambia, the same sort of deal. They didn't have a mechanic to repair them. They didn't teach the people how to repair them. So you've got to have an on-the-ground project manager. And the other key element is that project manager needs to speak the local language. And I think that's where we've seen enormous failures with all sorts of NGO projects, is that they don't have anyone who actually understands the culture. And to understand the culture, you need to speak the language.
Yeah. And we should say, for listeners who might not know, NGO is non-governmental organization, usually a humanitarian aid group or charity. But what lessons are there to be learned in what you saw with the bike program?
All NGOs, especially small ones, go through these early stages of kind of learning where things fall apart and how they can prevent that. And it also takes understanding that there are probably 100 ways to skin a cat, and that the way that you present isn't necessarily the only way it's going to work in that culture, because things are different in another culture.
Have you been in contact with the people you left behind in Botswana since your last visit?
I have.
Has anything changed?
Everything has changed, actually. We hired a local worker as a bicycle mechanic to travel around to these different projects with all his tools and be in charge of maintaining these bicycles. That's his job. He's paid to keep the bikes moving. So all of the 200 bicycles are in operation right now.
All right. Mark Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy. I enjoyed it.
Mark Jenkins is a freelance journalist who works with Bicycling Magazine. He joined us from Laramie, Wyoming. British pop star Elton John had a similar idea. He donated 120 bikes to healthcare workers in the Kingdom of Lesotho so they could get to patients in remote areas. Lesotho is a mountainous country, and regular bicycles wouldn't have been much help. So Elton John and his AIDS Foundation invested in motorbikes. The 5-year program is being run in partnership with the Lesotho government. It will help maintain the motorbikes, and it will teach local healthcare workers how to ride safely on Lesotho's rural roads. Coming up, North Koreans who flee their country in search of freedom find that it comes with a price. That story ahead on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Every year, about 300,000 Mexicans head north to the U.S. in search of work. Sometimes they leave behind their jobs in factories and on farms, and that can be a problem for their Mexican employers. Conrad Fox reports from the village of Guadalupe in southern Veracruz.
Sugarcane farmer Jose Zarate stands in the midst of 8-foot-high sugarcane, sharpening a machete and looking closely at his plants. The leaves are brown, and the cane is thin.
The fields fill up with water and damage the crops. That's why it's like this.
Ideally, Sarate's entire 14 acres of crop would have been harvested by now. But it's languished in the field, a full 3 months longer than it should have.
It's taking too long to harvest. I used to do well when we harvested in time.
Why the delay? There's simply not enough local labor here anymore. Martin Ruiz is the head of the local growers' organization.
Everyone's emigrated to the U.S. We took a census recently and found 700 neighbors were in the U.S. out of a population of 3,400. We've got a shortfall of 1,400 workers, so we've got to bring in people from other states, and that's expensive.
Out in a field that borders Jose Sarate's, 140 men slash at the sugar canes with machetes, then fling them on bundles that will later be hauled away by truck. They'll do this for 7 hours, 12 hours a day. The temperature is 104 degrees, and because the fields are set alight the day before to burn off undergrowth, the men are black from head to toe with soot. One of them is Miguel Hilario, a Mazatec Indian from a remote village hundreds of miles away in the state of Oaxaca.
It's hard. It's hard, but you gotta tough it out. If you don't, you don't eat. All day working. You don't go to the shade because then you don't earn anything. Here, you earn a bit at least. Back home, there's nothing.
5 years ago, this job was a staple for local laborers. But increasingly, entire families have been emigrating from the region to the U.S. Farmers have had to hire workers like Hilario from other, poorer parts of the country, where emigration hasn't yet taken hold, usually in remote indigenous villages. Carmela Rodriguez is the owner of this small field. Like Jose Sarate, she says she earned about $2,000 on her crop last year. She complains hiring workers from such out-of-the-way places is eating up that small profit.
We're paying to bring them here. We pay their transport, their accommodation, and a lot of them, they come up, work 2 weeks, and then disappear. And what are we supposed to do? Last year, we had to cut all the crops ourselves.
Every year, Rodriguez and her neighbors chip in for the costs of finding and bringing workers from Oaxaca and other poor southern states. This season, well over half the laborers are from other states. And while that's driven up farmers' costs, the workers' wages have stayed the same, about $70 a week. Sergio Falcón, who helps run this farm, admits it's not a living wage.
You can hardly survive on it. There's no money if you get sick. If you buy food, you've got nothing left over for a soda.
But, say farmers like Falcón and Rodriguez, sugar prices are too low to pay any more than that. And as long as prices are low, laborers will keep crossing the border to the U.S. in search of work. And it's not only laborers. Now, even the sugarcane farmers who employ them are going too. People like Sergio Falcón.
I work in the U.S. temporarily. I've been there 3 times now. I've got to, because otherwise, what do we do? Imagine trying to support a family on $2,000 a year.
At the beginning of this year, tariffs that Mexico places on sugar imports from the U.S. disappeared as part of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The threat of new competition has many sugarcane farmers talking about leaving the business for good. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Guadalupe, Veracruz, Mexico.
Now, here's this week's Globe at a Glance. When foreign countries are in the news, the topics are often about war and violence. It doesn't make the news when a nation is exceptionally peaceful, but today it does. We want to tell you about some of the countries that have been dubbed the most peaceful places on Earth. The Global Peace Index, or GPI, came up with a list. Countries were judged on how often they went to war and how much they spent on their military. They're also judged by internal violence, the number of people in jail, the level of violent crime, and terrorism. According to the GPI, the most peaceful country of 2007 was Iceland, followed by Denmark, Norway, and New Zealand. Probably no surprises there. Among the least peaceful are Chad, Afghanistan, Sudan, and Iraq. Businessman Steve Kildea founded the Global Peace Index. He's a multimillionaire philanthropist who traveled the world visiting war-torn countries, studying the way violence impacts the economies of those countries. Kildea hopes the Global Peace Index will spur research into the connection between peace and economic development and lead to an increase in both around the world. That's our Globe at a Glance. You're listening to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Looks like North Korea is losing its membership in the Axis of Evil. The State Department has said it's removing that country from the list of nations that sponsor terrorism. That's in response to increased openness about its nuclear program. The U.S. will also lift some sanctions, but that's probably unlikely to stop some desperate North Koreans from trying to get out of the country. Many have fled the harsh communist regime over the years. 11,000 defectors are now living in South Korea and facing challenges few expected. From Seoul, Jason Strother reports.
Byun-nan Hee says that prosperous South Korea is unlike anything she had ever dreamed of. We are brainwashed in North Korea. We were told that South Koreans are poor and the slaves of Americans, even more poor than us.
Sipping on a cup of green tea inside a trendy cafe, you'd never know that Nan-hee wasn't South Korean. She's fashionably dressed and uses a few English words when she talks. The only thing that gives her away is her accent. This 28-year-old asked that we not use her real name. She's lived in Seoul for almost 6 years now, but says she still can't forget the horror of her life back in North Korea.
During the famine in the 1990s, so many people died in my village. Every morning, we would wake up and hear about who did not survive over the night, especially children. Mothers could not feed their babies. Many were born with deformities or died shortly after birth.
Nan-hee herself almost didn't make it through the famine. In 1997, she became deathly ill, and her family did not have enough money to buy medicine. So her two older brothers carried her across the Tumen River into China, where she was nursed back to health. Like many other North Koreans who escape into China, Nan-hee and her brothers crisscrossed back and forth to bring food to their family. But during one journey, her brother was caught by border guards and was sentenced to public execution. After that, Nan-hee knew she could never return home again. With the help of a South Korean human rights group, Nan-hee was smuggled out of China. In 2002, she began her new life in Seoul.
In South Korea, you can really feel the freedom. In North Korea, there is no freedom at all.
Under the totalitarian regime in North Korea, many aspects of life are dictated by the government. Nan-hee says that from the time you're a child in North Korea, you pretty much know how your life is going to be.
Back in North Korea, you don't have many options unless you become a soldier or have the money to go to college. You do what your father does. If he is a miner, you become a miner. If he is a farmer, you become a farmer. When I was young, I had no hope at all about my future.
But ironically, many refugees don't know how to handle their new liberties, and some find it almost impossible to relate to their South Korean peers.
Young children get bullied and say they want to go back home. We don't even know what to talk to South Koreans about. We don't know about actors or video games. We can't have conversations with them. It's difficult to make friends.
It's part of a cultural gap that has widened since the two Koreas were split 60 years ago.
There are huge cultural differences, even a language barrier.
That's Hu Kang-il, who defected from North Korea in 1993. He's now president of a North Korean advocacy group in Seoul.
Even though we are the same people, we have a difficult time adjusting to the capitalist way of life. Even elites from North Korea cannot get good jobs here because of these obstacles.
Hu says that means that the vast majority of North Korean refugees struggle to survive here.
More than 70% of the refugees who now live in South Korea are unemployed or in poverty.
Often, the only work refugees can find are low-paying, so-called 3D jobs. Dirty, difficult, and dangerous. Hu says he wanted to help his fellow defectors and give them much-needed stability. So in 2005, he founded the Paektu Food Factory and hired over a dozen North Koreans in need of work. Workers on the factory floor pound globs of white dough into a giant mixer. Long strands of buckwheat noodles are then strained out. The noodles are used in a popular North Korean-style soup called naengmyeon. The factory has given defectors like 42-year-old Won Young-jin work to be proud of and a steady income. Won says when he arrived in South Korea 2 years ago, the only job he could find was as a delivery man. He couldn't earn enough money to support his wife and son who defected with him. Now he's the factory manager. Mr. Hu, the factory's owner, says that as profits increase, he hopes to expand his business and hire up to 50 more defectors. As for Byun Nan-hee, she says she didn't want to end up in poverty like other refugees. It was a struggle, but later this year, she'll graduate from college with a degree in social welfare. But she says she'll never feel completely settled into her new home, knowing that her parents and sister are still inside North Korea.
But I know that thinking like that won't help me or anyone else. If our countries do reunite one day, I know that I will be able to finally help my family.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
And now to another country that, like North Korea, was also once in the axis of evil, Iraq. Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds 20 years ago during the Iran-Iraq War. Now hundreds of children in the region suffer from heart defects, some say from lingering effects of the chemicals. Jeremy Courtney is an aid worker living in northern Iraq. He wanted to find money to get the children medical treatment. The solution lay at his feet, literally, in a pair of Kurdish shoes from the local market.
As I wore the shoes around town, people started commenting on them. As I wore the shoes among my American friends, they started saying, "Those look neat. I think people in America would like those." And we kind of just had an aha moment, and we threw up a website and asked some friends to look at it and consider it and buy a pair of shoes and promised to give all the profit to kids that we were meeting with that needed heart surgeries. We had a goal of selling 10 shoes within a couple weeks, and that quickly became 40, and then it just kind of took off from there.
There must be something very unique about these shoes that people would stop you and notice that you were wearing Kurdish shoes. Can you describe them for us?
Yeah, the shoes themselves are made out of almost entirely cloth. The bottom is a bunch of individual pieces of fabric strung together with strips of leather, and it becomes a sole on which to walk that's almost impenetrable. And after about 35 hours of work by hand, you have a clash, the Kurdish name for these shoes.
And how long have the Kurds been wearing these shoes?
Well, by some accounts, they've been wearing them since 600 years before Christ. A lot of people that have looked at the website or seen other pictures in print have been surprised to then hold the shoe in their hand and see that it actually is a very unique, almost like a work of art.
So how does the money you make selling these shoes provide heart surgery for a Kurdish child?
We partner with a local organization that basically does the background check for us on the families. We then take that child and recommend that child for surgery to an organization that we work with in Jordan and Israel, an organization called Shevet Achim. And that organization partners Jewish doctors with Arab and or predominantly Muslim children that need heart surgeries. And it's an effort to bring peace to some of these groups of people that have been so frequently not at peace with each other. And so when someone finds that their child is on the deathbed and the only way forward is at the hands of, you know, the doctor who might be an enemy, sometimes you find that your ideals and your previously held hate goes out the window for the sake of your child's health.
Can you tell us the stories of any of these recipients of the heart surgery that you've been involved in?
Yeah, I mean, the child that's kind of closest to our heart is a kid named Aras. Aras is about a 12-year-old. He's a 12-year-old boy from Halabja. Halabja is the site of a really devastating attack on the Kurds. And so his family and his people, they've all suffered a great deal, specifically at the hands of Saddam Hussein and throughout the 80s in the Iran-Iraq War. And his heart problem itself may very well be an after effect of Saddam's attacks on the Kurds. Aras is, he's a normal kid. You know, he likes to play soccer, and he likes to run out in the street with his friends and ride his bike. And I mean, he's a kid, and he has dreams. He has things he wants to do when he grows up. And thankfully, now that he's had his heart surgery and he's doing well and healing, that seems more likely than ever.
Why does your organization just focus on heart surgery for children? Is there some unique need, or are there more heart problems in this area than other problems?
There is a high incidence of heart disease here among children. The speculation from medical professionals here seems to suggest that malnutrition is a high factor, streptococcus virus that can lead to rheumatic fever, and then rheumatic heart disease is a big problem here. And then the third wide point of speculation is that Saddam's gas attacks on the Kurds, some 280 incidences in the 1987 and 88 time period, have all contributed to the high rate of heart disease on children here.
But these kids wouldn't have even been alive then.
Right. In terms of the gas attacks, the speculation goes that it has actually caused genetic problems, and now the problems that the parents had are being passed on to the children that are being born today.
So how does somebody over here in America get their hands on these shoes?
Well, right now the only avenue to buy the shoes is to log on to buyshoessavelives.com. And the shoes cost $100 for themselves, $10 for shipping, plus tax.
I went online myself and I saw that you can also follow the progress of the children. You have pictures of the children who you've helped get surgery and little write-ups on them, so people can not only buy the shoes but follow the medical care of the kids.
Yeah, and in the spirit of fair trade, we're really trying to make it known that the shoemakers are people too. And so we want to make sure that they get their story told just alongside the kids who have heart problems. This isn't sweatshop labor, you know, this is family apprenticed artisanship.
You set this up as a for-profit business, not a non-profit. Some people might call this capitalism with a humanitarian goal. How do you explain it?
I don't know what to call it. It's business, but it's charity. I mean, it's both. And so on paper, it's for-profit, and we have a double bottom line. We have to sell shoes, and we have to save lives. And if we fail to do either one of those things, then things pretty much fall apart.
Jeremy Courtney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeremy Courtney is founder of Buy Shoes, Save Lives, an online company that sells handmade Kurdish shoes to fund heart surgery for Iraqi children. You can find out more at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, hairdressers bring hope to the women of Sierra Leone. And we're not just talking hairstyles here. More on that on the World Vision Report after this short break. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back. Our next story takes us to Sierra Leone on the coast of West Africa. That nation was nearly destroyed by more than a decade of civil war. It's been 6 years since the war ended. Rebuilding is slow. Many basic amenities, like electricity, are in short supply. But reporter Naomi Schwartz has a story on how some Sierra Leoneans are turning the country's lack of power into an entrepreneurial opportunity. Here's the latest installment in our street vendor series.
In a makeshift shack, about a half dozen young guys take turns playing video game soccer on a small TV. They sit on wooden benches and plastic chairs. And as points go back and forth, the game can get heated. Other young men strain to see inside through a wide window. For less than 20 cents, you can get 4 minutes of playtime here. 22-year-old Alvin Williams takes plenty of turns playing. But he doesn't need to pay because this is his shop. And what he's really selling is something few of the boys, including him, have at home. Electricity. That's because there aren't enough power plants to supply the city, and those that exist are old and unreliable. So that means the power is almost never on. Shop owner William says he hasn't had power at his house in more than a week.
From last Saturday, it's gone. So up to now.
So entrepreneurs like Williams fill the power gap. The long cord stretches from the back of William's shop to an unfinished building next door. A small generator hums inside. Back inside the shop, the video game announcer gives the play-by-play incessantly. The game consoles are plugged into the maze of surge protectors on the floor. Williams uses the extra outlets to provide another service. For about 35 cents, Williams will plug in anything you need charging, as long as it doesn't block the video games. Most people come to juice up their cell phones. Williams opened his shop 2 months ago. It's a natural fit. He's an electrical engineering student at a local college. He says he'll use the profits from his shop to pay for school.
I don't decide to do that because I'm a student, so I have no facilities to pay my fees. Getting money to pay my fees, that's why.
He had to borrow $100 to buy the generator, and he is still repaying the loan. But William says he couldn't find other work. Unemployment in Sierra Leone tops 70% and is even higher among the young. William says it's all part of the harsh reality of life in Sierra Leone, which he describes as Bobo Pen, a slang term that means...
the hard life. So a really hard life.
But Williams hasn't given up hope for his country, and neither have his customers, who debate politics as they wait for their telephones to charge. For the World Vision Report, I'm Naomi Schwartz in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The lack of power in Sierra Leone is something Diane Stevens knows all about. Stevens spent some time in the country training women in cosmetology. It started one day in the salon and spa she owns in Maryland.
A woman from my church, she actually is a client of mine, and she came to the salon and told me about her work in Sierra Leone. She actually shared photos of a camp filled with amputees who were victim of a 10-year-long war. I heard about the plight of the women there, and she told me about a person that worked there, and she was a hairstylist, so of course that caught my attention. I had no plan on going to Africa. That was just not in my thought process. But every morning at 3 a.m., I would wake up and think about Sierra Leone. So I thought, okay, God is clearly trying to tell me something. So that's when I prayed and thought, maybe we can just do something where we can help them economically. I identified three women from my church, and then I rounded up three women from the salon, three women that were very, very excited about teaching a curriculum in cosmetology. Well, over in Sierra Leone, they put up flyers and said their Americans are going to come and a cosmetology program is going to happen. They had to turn women away because we didn't have a facility large enough to house more than 300 people. Well, when we walked into the facility, there were women outside because the facility could only hold about 150 women. It was such a small room and everybody was packed in like sardines. And the women, they were singing when we walked in the room. So, of course, we all started crying. It was just so overwhelming. I was just truly humbled. I just felt like I wanted to do everything that I could to impact the women there. We totally taught them as if it was a cosmetology school. So we started out with the basics, even just the regular shampoo. So we didn't have any water supply, so the women brought 50 buckets of water, put it on their heads, and brought it to the center. They wound up creating like a makeshift. They had a half of a hose that was cut open on both ends. So they put the hose in the bucket of water, and they siphoned it out with their mouth, and then they created like a little waterfall. So we were able to rinse our clients out. Then after that, we started showing them how to do finishing. They were amazed at the blow-dry techniques. I don't know if they've ever even seen a blow-dryer, but we realized there was no electricity. We had to rent a generator, but they had a big fan plugged in because there was, no air conditioning. So when we plugged in our supplies, our finishing tools, like our blow-dryers, it would cut the fan off. So now it's about 120 degrees in this place. So we're just dripping wet. It was just unbelievable. They would model their hair. These women were so talented. They're going to be practicing on each other and getting better and better. A lot of them said, well, Miss Diane, well, where will we get a job? When actually we found out they weren't even eating. And I said, well, there's a woman, when we were driving from our hotel to the center, we noticed bread stands, fruit stands. I said, well, maybe we should start with bartering. And if you would do that young lady's hair in a beautiful style, maybe you could feed your family for a week. They're feeding their families. They're exchanging for medical supplies. There's a nurse in town. The nurse now comes in one day a week. She comes into the center and gets her hair done. And so it is just amazing that the women are finding ways to survive. And that's a start. It gave them just a hope. And that's what we saw in their eyes. although I love my clients and this is always wonderful, when you do work from your heart, you just never forget the importance and the meaning of that job. So I'll always be a giver backer. I'm going to always give back in some area because the reward is so big.
Diane Stevens is heading back to Sierra Leone soon. She took time out from her hair salon that does have electricity and water to speak to us from Washington, D.C. It's difficult to imagine Africa at the forefront of a technological revolution, but when it comes to mobile telephones, it is. Even the most remote and lawless places are getting connected. Commentator Nigel Marsh is the Africa Communications Director for World Vision, the sponsor of this show. He experienced the cell phone revolution firsthand on a visit to Somalia.
Think of Somalia, and words like war-torn and devastated come readily to mind. But it was here, on a side street in the crumbling town of Baidoa, that I unexpectedly stumbled on a 15-foot satellite dish. The beaming owner welcomed me in and explained that the dish was part of his new mobile phone company. He offered international phone calls for $1.50 a minute, a lower cost than was then available in most of Africa. "Why so cheap?" I asked. After all, this was a valuable monopoly. "Not so," said the Baidoa businessman in mock shock. "There was another company across town providing exactly the same service." "But the cell phones the rival was offering were bigger and less fashionable," he added quickly, anxious that I recognize he had the best deal in town. That was 6 years ago. Up until then, humanitarians, business people, even politicians in Somalia and many other parts of the continent had to rely on prohibitively expensive satellite phones or high-frequency radio to make contact with the outside world. But today, communications technology is revolutionizing Africa. Mobile phone coverage is expanding faster here than anywhere else. Most towns have roadside stalls selling airtime, connections on computer chip cards, or simply calls on the stall owner's phone. Actual phone calls remain too expensive for many cell phone users, but short message service, or SMS, is hugely popular. It allows the transmission of a tiny text message for around 5 cents. Appointments are made this way, friendships maintained, crop prices checked. Many Africans who travel to find work, and even some who have been displaced by conflict, keep in touch with relatives by SMS. We can't be too starry-eyed, of course. There are difficulties that stop many Africans from getting connected. Electricity lags behind cell phone coverage in many countries, so potential users can't always recharge their phone batteries. And far too many Africans still earn so little that they can't participate in even this revolution. But for the millions who can, it's a welcome sign that something so modern can spread so quickly in Africa. It hints at a possible future where the chasm that separates lives in the poorest and richest countries may be partly bridged rather than always broadened by consumer technology.
Nigel Marsh is the African Communications Director for World Vision. We close today's show in the Caribbean. Jamaica is a country famous for its music. Think Bob Marley, reggae, and rap. There are 21 radio stations in the capital city alone. Reporter Judith Ritter has this story on a unique station that broadcasts more than just music.
Norma Coleman, Auntie Norma to her neighbors, lives here in a tiny cement bungalow surrounded by a dirt yard where a scrawny dog and a few chickens scratch at the hard earth. A heavy metal gate seals off the yard. 10 years ago, Auntie Norma was a nurse in a hospital here in Jamaica. But health problems and hard times changed that. Most days now, she sits here at a cluttered kitchen table surrounded by old photos. A few years ago, her leg was amputated. Her crutches lean against a glass cabinet full of bits of china and imitation Hummel figurines.
My favorite things is those figurines. I don't worship them, but I love them. Because each time I get my pay, I always buy a set of figurines. Each time I look at them, I remember my years that I spent at the Bellevue Hospital.
She spends much of her time listening to the radio, Roots 96.1 to be exact.
Roots 96.1 FM, the voice of the inner city.
Roots helped me a lot in my life. If you are in need, Roots is there for you. My husband was sick. They gave me a letter, an x-rays to go to take a brain scan. Food, if I want food, they send me food. They are there for me in every possible way that you can think of.
How does a radio station help people with food and brain scans? Well, with the help of its listeners.
Once somebody puts a request on the radio, you bet your last dollar that within 48 hours, the community, whether they know this person or not, they get together and they pool their own very limited resources.
Rosamond Brown is Roots General Manager. She says the majority of listener donations are as little as a dollar. Brown sits in an office filled with mismatched chairs, aging computers. She's one of just two full-time employees here.
Right here at Roots FM 96.1 FM band, that's all we do. And that's why we play these type of songs.
The station depends on a team of volunteers to broadcast call-in shows that encourage reading and other shows that link jobless callers with employers or help people with legal problems. Roots operates on small grants from UNESCO and from support from the Christian charity Mustard Seed. Ideas for programs come from the listeners and from the DJs. For instance, one DJ had volunteered in the prison system.
And that spun off into a radio program called Unchained. And that program really is where the inmates themselves use that as a way to encourage young people in the community by saying that where we are on the inside, it is not good, it is not wholesome. This is no feather in your cap, don't do this. So you find when the message comes from somebody on the inside, it makes it that much more real.
This is Mekwe Talk, your one-hour talk show, hosted by Larmon Lynch.
Yes, you're listening to Mekwe Talk on Roots 96.1 FM, the voice of the inner city. Blessed love to all those down there in Raytown and those listening.
One of the station's most popular shows is hosted by Larmon Lynch.
This is your
program. Slender 23-year-old sits behind the microphone every day from 11 to noon and fields calls about poverty, crime.
Good morning, caller.
Yes, Mr. Lynch.
Blessed.
My mom leaves me at age 17 in this house with nothing.
Problems he knows about firsthand.
My father was murdered when I was 12 years old. I've witnessed murders. I've witnessed the drug trade. I've witnessed it all.
And that personal experience compels him to work to improve the community. He helped one listener start a soup kitchen. He organized and broadcast a panel discussion with gang members. And his work with the gangs doesn't stop in the studio.
I go to the street corner. I go and just hang out with them on the street corner at the bar to have what is called street theater. We dramatize a better Jamaica and we dramatize what Jamaica is now. And we start a discussion with them from that drama piece.
Annie McKenzie listens to Roots Radio in just the kind of neighborhood Lynch visits.
When I listen to Roots, trust me, Roots are there for me all the time.
Today, the streets outside Annie's immaculate little house are uncharacteristically quiet. A few idlers lean against buildings. The occasional passing car is scrutinized suspiciously. The streets are barricaded with rusted upturned cars, bed springs, and smoldering trash barrels. The smell of smoke lingers and the tension is palpable. It's here that several nights ago, six alleged gunmen were shot and killed by the police. This is Tivoli. The residents here live in isolation, often afraid to venture outside. But Roots has broken that isolation for people like Annie.
Yeah, you know, Roots helped me in the time of my grief.
When her son was murdered, the first thing she did was call into her favorite show. In return, she was inundated with phone calls from listeners, and Roots staff helped with the funeral.
Trust me, I can't even find words to express. They support me with their love. Yeah, you know, they give me inner strength.
She's a masterpiece, exclusive and kind.
What a strong, strong song. Conscious, cultural. It's all about something special to empower communities, and that's why we play.
Back inside the station, a show called Rootsology is on.
Yeah, you know. Life is no coincidence.
Outside, along the edge of the building, the vegetable seedlings that the staff planted are just taking hold. Soon listeners will drop by, and they'll take those plants home. And on the ledges of dusty cracked windows or in tiny backyards full of litter, those little plants will root deeply and reach for the sun.
Don't let the system get to you. Just believe in yourself.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Kingston, Jamaica.
Just believe in yourself. Hey, then show them you're strong enough to overcome this tragedy. Hit the street to win the street to find some food and money. Furthermore, I am the breadwinner for the family.
And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can find out more about the program at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can see photographs there and listen to the show, or you can sign up for a podcast if you want to take us with you. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.